Speaking out about the threat to human rights, the defender and others from her community had their homes burned down and were forced from their land on three occasions.
Wait for that. Andrew Johnson is a Canadian photojournalist. A few years ago, he was in the Amazon rainforest in Pará, a state in the north of Brazil. He was at the site of a massive gold mine project. If it goes through, this huge mine in the jungle, well, it will be the biggest gold mine in Brazil, worth an estimated $8 billion. Andrew was there to work on a documentary. He knew that this project was controversial. Locals and activists had been trying to stop it. He wanted to see what everything looked like for himself. That's when he noticed the truck from the security company.
I took photos of them, and they basically pulled up in their truck, and he came out of his truck and basically didn't say much and kind of just looked at me kind of warily and walked around, and then I was basically just taking photos from the hip. And the guy noticed, and he got all upset. He got really pissed off, and he basically said, "Why are you taking pictures of the truck?" And I'm like, "Is that a problem? I'm a journalist, you know. Like, it's you know, I have every right to take a picture on public land." And yeah, he basically, you know, it's like, "No, you can't. You can't take photos of the truck. You can't." Blah 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 blah. Anyway, it was just basically getting kind of irate.
Andrew got out of that situation unharmed. Fact is, he was used to it by then. It was not the first time that he had been followed or questioned by the security company that he and many others assumed was working for the mining company. And the mining company, well, they had every reason to want to protect their reputation. Troubling stories were leaking out of Brazil, and eventually, these stories would reach the United Nations. UN Special Rapporteur Mary Lawler investigated these stories, and what she found out disturbed her. It wasn't just journalists who said that they were being harassed and threatened. Local farmers and protesters and members of indigenous communities, Lawler's investigation found credible claims that they had been threatened, intimidated, legally and physically harassed.
The human rights defenders in the area have been targeted in attacks aimed at forcing them from their homes and land. And it has been happening in the context of increased land prices driven by Belosun.
Belosun. It's a Canadian mining company. You probably haven't heard of them. We had never heard of them. And we did an entire season of our show Commons all about Canadian mining and its problems around the world. The name Belosun never came up. This is not Barrick or Teck. This is not one of these massive global leaders. Belosun's corporate address is a small residential house in Toronto. So who is Belosun? How did they become the driving force behind the biggest proposed gold mine in Brazil? Are they guilty of the things that they're accused of? And if so, how is the Canadian government allowing it all to happen? Cherise Souchurin has this report. Wait for it.
There's a man standing in a wide hole in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. He's wearing casual street clothes, a t-shirt, pants, and a baseball cap. He takes a shovel and loosens some dirt from the side of the hole. Then with his hands, he scoops the dirt into a pan and carries it over to a murky pond at the bottom, where he mixes the dirt and pond water into a sort of brown slurry. But when he pours the water out, a silvery, glittery sand remains in the pan. It's gold. At least it's gold ore before it's refined into the metal we all know. I'm watching footage shot last year by Canadian journalist Andrew Johnson in Brazil. He's showing how indigenous people mine gold by hand. They're known as artisanal miners, also called wildcat miners, subsistence miners, or garimpeiros, depending on who you ask. The practice is controversial, as the mercury used to refine the gold goes back into waterways. But as the man in the footage explains, he can't mine more than a few ounces at a time with his small-scale machinery. However, he doesn't need to dig too deep or too much to get what he's after. In the video, he motions to the land around him. All of this, he says, has gold. And that's exactly why Canadian companies have swooped down into the Brazilian jungle. Buried too deep for artisanal miners to reach are some of the largest deposits of gold in the world. And demand for gold has never been higher.
Gold has jumped about 22% this year to hit record highs.
Gold prices have hit a fresh record high.
Welcome back. Now our top line story. Gold is back in the spotlight. Yesterday, the spot price of gold touched $2,483.73 US per ounce. That's its highest price ever.
With the highest price ever in history, Canadian mining companies stand to make record profits. Canadian companies are global giants when it comes to mining. You've probably heard of Barrick Gold and Goldcorp, which operate dozens of mines worldwide. And it's a Canadian company called Bellows Sun that is currently attempting to build a mine on what they say is a deposit of up to 3.8 million ounces of gold, worth more than $8 billion, and which they say would provide economic benefit to the area. But Bellows Sun isn't a corporate giant. Their Brazilian mining project, called the Volta Grande, is the only project in their portfolio. The problem is, the gold that they're after is located right where our artisan miner and many other indigenous communities live. So once the mining project was proposed, it was met with resistance from local people who argued that it would harm the environment and indigenous land rights. And this fight has drawn international scrutiny. Just a few months ago, the UN Special Rapporteur, who represents human rights defenders, expressed concern about Bellows Sun's actions towards these activists. She said people protesting the Bellows Sun mine report being threatened and harassed, and how the company was using legal means to intimidate the defenders. Bellows Sun denies these allegations. They say they care about human rights, and the government of Brazil itself approves of their activities in the region. They say that they would be able to actually enrich the area by taking advantage of the billions worth of gold under the earth. So, which is it? Are land defenders and local artisanal miners making false claims to drive Canadian competition off their land? Or are Canadian mining executives violating human rights for an $8 billion payout? For the land defenders, the case against megaprojects is simple to understand because mining accidents in Brazil have already caused massive environmental destruction. In 2019, an iron ore tailings dam from a mining company called Vale collapsed, unleashing toxic contaminants which engulfed the town and surrounding area.
On January 25th, sludge flooded out of the bowels of the earth. Nearly a million cubic meters of mine waste spilled over 7 kilometers, destroying everything in its path.
The accident killed at least 270 people. Except that wasn't the only disaster that decade, or the only one involving Vale. The Samarco iron ore mine collapsed in 2015 and killed 19 people. It caused more damage than any previous disaster over hundreds of kilometers of land. But a catastrophic accident doesn't have to happen for a major project to upend the lives of local people. And this is a big part of the resistance to Bellows Sun, because just a few kilometers away from the Bellows Sun mine site is a massive dam project called the Belo Monte. There's no relation to Bellows Sun, the names are a coincidence. But the Belo Monte hydroelectric dam, which opened in 2016, stopped the natural flow of the Xingu River, which indigenous people relied on for their way of life. As part of the plan, it flooded hundreds of square kilometers of surrounding land. This is photojournalist Andrew Johnson. He's been to this area of Brazil, known as the Volta Grande de Xingu, many times, and he's seen the changes happening to communities in the shadow of the dam.
It's the third largest hydroelectric dam in the world. What it did was it drastically reduced the water level of the Xingu to the point where travel by river is made a lot more difficult.
There were many indigenous people in the region, people whose livelihoods were impacted by the dam.
So there's the Juruna, or the Yujia, which their name literally means lords of the river. So these are people who their identity and their way of life is intimately tied, connected to the river.
The dam forced the indigenous people to move elsewhere and start new lives.
When the river flooded upriver of the dam, that flooded those islands, they were removed. So they were basically sent to the city to live, and a lot of them live in quite dire situations in the city, in these little kind of makeshift homes that were thrown together to house this basically internally displaced peoples, essentially. So a lot of them are forced to move somewhere else. Some of them went a little further afield to try their hand at farming away from the river. And a lot of them went into the city to try to find work. And some of them live on, you know, social assistance.
So while the dam powers nearby cities, many of the indigenous people in the area say it has only brought them devastation and poverty. And the idea of another mega project in the same area is something many won't stand for. Environmental groups and local farmers and indigenous people have made their objection to the project clear. And in 2022, when a contract between Belo Sun and a governmental agency gave the company access to land that had previously been intended for farmers, approximately 100 farmers and indigenous people set up an encampment on the land. In October 2023, Belo Sun fought back, filing a criminal complaint against 40 people, including 33 of the encampment farmers and three representatives from environmental organizations. The company alleged they had been trespassing on the land. I want to tell you about another man standing in the Amazon rainforest. But this time, the man is surrounded by people. There's music playing, food cooking, people milling around. Because this is a company Christmas party, and the man, not used to the Brazilian heat, is sweating under the sun. So I'm paraphrasing, but that's how Mark Eaton, Belo Sun CEO, was described in a 2014 profile in the Globe and Mail. That was the year Belo Sun Mining Corporation won an environmental license to work in Brazil. The company was only 2 years old at the time. Eaton was an equities broker in the resource industry, and he had little technical background in mining. But in this profile, he was described as having a positive outlook on the Brazil project. He was reported as saying it would bring 2,000 jobs in the first phase, some which could go to the artisanal miners working on the land. That was part of Belo Sun's plans, to bring economic development and responsible, safe mining to the region. And alongside Eaton was Peter Tagliamonte, another executive of Belo Sun. He was a mining engineer and he came with experience across Central and South America. In a presentation to potential investors in 2016, he spoke of the economic benefits of the mine, arguments that have been supported by government leaders in Brazil.
And whenever you can have a mine operating close by a city where people can work, their kids can get educated, it ultimately translates into a more efficient operation and a more cost-effective operation.
But almost 10 years on, the project has faced significant challenges and opposition. Belo Sun's environmental and construction licenses have been suspended multiple times. There are ongoing accusations that they didn't obtain free, prior, and informed consent from indigenous communities. And environmental groups like Amazon Watch have accused Belo Sun of misleading investors about the project's risks. So why has the UN become involved in this fight, involving a relatively small mining company and a project that hasn't even gotten off the ground? Reports of harassment and threats towards protesters of the Belo Sun mine have ramped up over the years. But what does that mean exactly? Here's Andrew Johnson again. He says that he's heard these accounts of harassment firsthand.
When I first started going there in 2018, people were more vocal. They weren't afraid of voicing their opposition. People were at odds, but they weren't afraid. That all changed basically from 2020, 21 onward. People are a lot more intimidated and afraid. One man told me that his home was broken into and he was basically slapped around and told to keep his opposition to the project to himself. So a threat.
Johnson alleges the intimidation is coming from two fronts. From people working for Invictus, a security firm hired by Belo Sun, and from local supporters of the mine.
So yeah, these intimidations happened from within the community, but then there's also the security firm, private security firm that Belo Sun hired, a company called Invictus. It's the same company that Belo Monte, the dam, Norte Energia, the company that runs the dam, hired. And Invictus basically are armed security that patrol between Belo Sun's two properties on either side of Hisaka, this community, this village. So it's who do you run to? And a lot of people don't trust the police.
Johnson also alleges that he has been followed by Invictus himself. for taking photos on the land near their mine site.
I'm a pretty white guy, and it's a pretty obvious, I speak Portuguese, but I speak with an accent, and I stand out like a sore thumb. There's no mistaking that I'm a foreigner, and I declared myself as a foreign journalist, so.
Right, so how did that altercation go? What happened?
I took photos of them, and they basically pulled up in their truck, and he came out of his truck and basically didn't say much and kind of just looked at me kind of warily and walked around and kind of inspected what these encampment folks were doing, who I was accompanying. And then I was basically just taking photos from the hip, and the guy noticed and he got all upset. He got really pissed off and he basically said, "Why are you taking pictures of the truck?" And I'm like, is that a problem? I'm a journalist. You know, like it's, I have every right to take a picture on public land. And he basically, it's like, no, you can't. You can't take photos of the truck. You can't, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, it was just basically getting kind of irate. But that wasn't the first time. I think the first time was probably in 2020, one of the earlier trips I did. And they did a similar thing. And they pull up in their truck again. Again, on public property, not on Belo Sun property, and get out, and they start asking, why are we filming? And, that's their way of intimidating, I guess, letting us know that they're watching.
It's these types of allegations coming from journalists, activists, land defenders, and more, which alerted the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights Defenders to Belo Sun's project in Brazil. Her name is Mary Lawler. And in March, she traveled to the area to speak to people on the ground. Her report from Brazil detailed concerns about allegations of threats and harassment from supporters of the mine, as well as security firm Invictus, as well as legal intimidation. So I wanted to talk to her directly about what she found out in Brazil and what evidence she'd found to support these allegations. Last week, she got on a call with me from her office in Ireland. So yeah, I was wondering how you first came to hear about these reports of threats.
Well, the way the mandate works is you get complaints into the mandate inbox, and they can come from anybody. And then the job of the mandate is to investigate it and to ensure that we are sure about the information. I never take up anything that I am not sure about. I have this motto, when in doubt, leave it out. And if we can't find trusted verification of what is going on, well, we don't take up the case. So this is what happened in the Belo Sun case. But these allegations have been going on since 2017. So it's a long time.
So how have you verified that?
Okay, so I can't make the specific details public because we always have to get consent from the person that we are writing a communication about. And in this case, the person has not consented to their name being put in the public sphere because they're afraid of reprisals. But I can say that they received very serious death threats after speaking out about the threat to human rights from Belo Sun's project specifically, and this has happened on multiple occasions. The human rights defenders in the area have been targeted in attacks aimed at forcing them from their homes and land. And it has been happening in the context of increased land prices driven by Belo Sun's project. And I am aware of a specific case, but again, I can't reveal the details as the human rights defender is afraid it might put them at risk. But in this case, the defender and others from her community had their homes burned down and were forced from their land on three occasions. I can say that a lot of the allegations that, when you're asking about evidence, a lot of the facts and issues that I've expressed concern about are in the report are facts.
Lawler also talked about the court case Belo Sun has brought against the human rights defenders and how she's heard concerns about Brazil's justice system being used to silence.
And, the company has brought a criminal case against people engaged in peaceful land occupation, and members of civil society organizations who've been supporting locals in the defense of their rights. And this case was recently sent to court by local prosecutor, which is very worrying, but not surprising. You know, when I was in Brazil, I spoke with countless government officials, as I said, justice workers and human rights defenders, and all of them agreed that the justice system is being misused by powerful actors, including foreign companies, to silence the peaceful defence of human rights. And I also spoke to another woman who was accused by Belo's son in the same complaint, and she's part of a women's rights movement in the area. And one day they went to the land occupation with food baskets to deliver food. And when they arrived, the security company photographed them, tried to prevent them from delivering the food. And it seems that this is the basis for her ending up in the lawsuit. So you can see that the substance of the complaint seems to suggest that it might represent an end, an attempt to put an end to opposition to the project.
After her investigation, she sent letters to the government of Canada, Belo's son, and its major investors, RBC and Sun Valley. And Lawler's final report from Brazil detailed allegations that human rights defenders against the mine were being threatened, harassed, and intimidated. She talked about allegations that the company was using what she called spurious legal procedure to intimidate the defenders. And she also mentioned allegations about the security company Invictus intimidating activists off the land, which Andrew Johnson mentioned earlier in this episode. But aside from the UN, journalists in Brazil have also been paying attention to Belo's son. In 2022, an investigation from Agência Pública reported that a Canadian investment bank called Forbes in Manhattan, which had close ties to the government of Brazil. The following is a translation from the original article in Portuguese.
FNM enjoyed direct access to the country's vice president, Hamilton Mourão, in a series of exclusive meetings in Brasília. According to a tranche of documents obtained by Agência Pública, the government's official agenda shows he has been present in meetings between Belo's son and the Bolsonaro government since 2019. In September of that year, acting on behalf of Belo's son, he met with leading officials from the Department for Geology and Mining from the Ministry of Mines and Energy.
Belo's son has responded to Lawler in an extensive letter posted on their website. They said they firmly reject the allegations and detailed how the project was in line with Brazilian laws and environmental standards. The letter stated, quote, the company does not engage in, nor will it tolerate, any effort to intimidate or silence opponents of the project, end quote. Belo's son goes on to say that they are not aware of any criminal lawsuits regarding the security contractor at their Brazil project or any charges with an offense relating to that project. They end with an invitation to Lawler. Quote, the company remains available to discuss all these matters and hopes the special rapporteur will avail themselves of that opportunity after they have reviewed the company's response. End quote. Candleland has also reached out to Belo's son for comment. They did not respond by press time. This past summer, Lawler was in Toronto to meet with representatives from the Canadian government to discuss her concerns about Brazil. So I asked her, what did she ask of the Canadian government? What power does the government actually have to hold companies accountable?
When I went to Canada, I met with the Canadian government and I called for three things. The first one was to bring in legislation that would oblige companies to carry out human rights and environmental due diligence in consultation with directly affected communities and human rights defenders, as has been done in other jurisdictions. And then the second thing I asked was that the Corps should be strengthened.
Lawler is referring to the Canadian Ombudsperson for Responsible Enterprise, also called Corps, which is Canada's watchdog on the international mining industry. It's been criticized for not having enough power to properly investigate companies abroad, and is currently under review after the former ombudsperson's term ended this summer.
And the other thing that needs to be done is Canada has these Voices at Risk guidelines, which are their guidelines for embassies and to help protect human rights defenders and to help support human rights defenders at risk, including where Canadian companies are involved. And I'm calling for the guidelines to be improved by updating the section on business and human rights to defenders to include mandatory language on support for defenders in the situation where Canadian companies are involved.
She also raised the point that European countries have been much stricter and have developed regulations that can put industry in check.
I mean, the EU, and the EU is 27 member states. It took them several years, but there is now legislation in place that obliges companies to carry out human rights and environmental due diligence, which is a good thing. So it's not impossible, but, you know, Canadian companies have to embrace that. And we do know that, for example, in Honduras, where there was a woman, indigenous woman killed, it was the pressure of the national and international community that actually, for the first time, brought accountability for the killing of Bertha Cáceres, and 8 members of the company were imprisoned. But the 2 investment banks, they both pulled out as a result. And they cannot use their shareholder price as a, you know, and their profit margins as an excuse for the attacking and killing of human rights defenders. And they really need to start by listening and by consulting and by getting free, prior and informed consent with those they are affecting.
In your communication with both the Government of Canada officials and with Bello Sun, do you feel like they're taking this seriously?
Well, yes. Everyone says they take you seriously. The proof will be at the end of the year, and in what we see in the revision of the core, which is very important, and, you know, what discussions they're having to consider my proposal. So that's really all I can say.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. This episode was brought to you by Manda Fortier, Heather Keane, and Daniel MC. This episode was reported by Charisse Suturin. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson and Sam Connert. Max Collins is our production manager. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
When you die in Canada Land, you die in real life. I'm Justin Ling, and today we're talking about the news. We'll be touching on the largely forgotten Polaris Prize, why Canadian weapons are still making their way to Gaza, but mostly we'll be talking with Paris Marx about AI, Elon Musk, and the first AI elections.
If we think that the cat's out of the bag, then it's like, oh, we can't do anything about it, right? But I think that we very clearly can do something about it.
Wait for that. I'm your host, Justin Ling, and I'm here with Paris Marx, author of the Disconnect newsletter, host of the Tech Won't Save Us podcast, and all-around smart person. Paris, thanks for being here.
Yeah, great to be back.
AI is making it harder for all of us to know what to trust in this election cycle.
Yeah, Justin Trudeau, no thanks. Justin Ling, yes, please.
But with the very real possibility of AI fakes...
I think Justin Ling is a stand-up guy, great journalist, one of the best. Sign up for his Substack.
Citizens and candidates will face a flood of falsehoods that suffocate serious civic debate.
Heard him on Canada Land, and I thought I love Canada. I love land, and I love Ling. That's a trifecta.
I love that so much. It's so stupid. Absolutely idiotic. Paris, stop me if you've heard this one before. The dawn of generative AI and large language models will mean a deluge of misinformation. Our elections will never be safe again. We are careening towards the end of truth. Yes, due to the mass proliferation of artificial intelligence, the internet and our society more broadly will be filled with images, songs, books, movies, and ideas cooked up by a series of algorithms on a server somewhere, sucking up more electricity than a stack of Prince Edward Islands. We thought we had more time, but unfortunately, tech writer Nick Bilton welcomed us recently in the pages of Vanity Fair to the AI election. Facing dizzying deepfakes and personalized propaganda, Bilton writes that the 2024 election cycle has been a turning point in the use of AI for political manipulation. And at the center of it, we have Elon Musk yet again to thank. Due to his sassy, non-woke, free speech alternative, Grok, released as a competitor to ChatGPT and Gemini and all of the others, Grok has been a minor player on the AI scene. But maybe we discounted Grok at our own peril. The large language model is now stuffing the election full of misinformation, Donald Trump memes, and anti-woke agitprop. Could this be a sign of things to come here in Canada? Well, we're going to find out. Paris, have we finally arrived at the end of truth ushered in by artificial intelligence?
I don't think so.
Ah, well, all right, well. That's the show.
How many times have I heard that before? You know, like, obviously it will present new obstacles, new things that we need to get around. But I think with a lot of this AI stuff, like, people can usually suss out, like, what is real and what is not. You know, maybe it's not always the case, but I think for the vast majority of people, that is true. I'm just not so concerned. Like, they were saying a lot of this about the Indian election as well, but I read a report in Rest of World recently that said, you know, everyone's expecting AI to, like, you know, lead to all this misinformation in India, and that didn't happen. You know, we'll see if it's going to happen here. I didn't hear much about it in the European elections that happened recently. So I don't know. I'm not really buying it at the moment.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of the warnings we've gotten, and we're going to break a lot of this down in some granular detail in a second, but just like at a high level, I feel like all of the things we were warned about now started happening. Like, we're dealing with them, right? Like, over the last year, we've seen instances of an AI Joe Biden doing robocalls in New Hampshire, telling voters to stay home.
It's important that you save your vote for the November election. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again.
There's an AI Taylor Swift who endorsed Donald Trump. There's Stable Diffusion'd images of big pro-Trump crowds, memes of gun-toting Trump and a wheelchair-bound Biden, you know, or more recently, these crazy memes of Donald Trump protecting our cats and dogs from, you know, from the roaming bands of migrants who want to eat your pets. Like, it feels like all of the things we worried about have happened, like all the crazy use cases are here. And it genuinely just sort of feels like they're not having much of an impact. And I think that's really interesting.
You know, it's easier to churn that stuff out now. It can happen quicker because we have these tools, but it's not like it was never possible to do these things in the past. Yeah. I remember, you know, through the Trump term and stuff, we would always be having these images of like Trump with this really muscular build and stuff, showing him as like, you know, leading the country into its great, wonderful future and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's not wholly new. It just took a bit more work to do that stuff then. And sure, it's polluting the ecosystem and like polluting what we see to a certain degree. But I'm really skeptical that the misinformation side of this is like the key thing that we need to be most worried about. Sure, we should be on guard. We should make sure that it doesn't become a big thing. But I feel like we often get these warnings and then it doesn't really result in like what we expect to happen.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go back to what Nick Bilton wrote in Vanity Fair, because he seems quite worried about all of this in a way that I read through this and I'm having a hard time sharing his level of concern. But he writes, once you start living in the land of AI, your brain starts to question everything, whether you like it or not. You begin to get a creeping suspicion that even the most straightforward images are indeed fake. I live in this space a lot. I don't experience any of this.
No, like, me neither.
Every once in a while, I'll see an image being like, and I'll really stare at it and go, okay, is this real? Is this? But like, I feel like I'm already tuned to recognizing at least kind of general kind of category of true and fake. And like, yeah, maybe I do a second step to verify stuff now that I wouldn't have done a couple years ago, but doesn't seem so bad.
I feel like when we talk about American politics in particular, and, you know, I'm sure more broadly as well, but there is often this kind of inflating of the role of technology in what is actually happening there. Like, you know, we can go back to 2016 and, you know, what came after that and all of the concern about, you know, Russian meddling in the election and how it was using Facebook and whatnot. There was certainly a bit of that, like Russia was buying ads on Facebook and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, it also served to cover over some of the deficiencies in the Democratic campaign. So they didn't have to talk about those things and could just say, oh, it was all Russia and they put Trump in and blah, blah, blah. Right. I'm not saying it's the same thing as that, but it does feel like we tend to overstate the potential impacts of technology on these things so that we don't need to talk about more kind of base and fundamental political things and material things that are actually happening here.
The point we're making here, I don't want to have a conversation that just says, don't worry, everything's fine. What I think is way more interesting is that AI is already starting having an impact in other ways, just not exactly as we anticipated. And I think this example of all of these, you know, Donald Trump protecting our cats and dogs and geese and ducks, I guess, memes are part of this, in that AI has not become a tool in this case to dupe people. It's become a fun participatory action that everyone can do to kind of contribute to the political propaganda process. And I think that is way more fascinating than, you know, little old ladies being tricked online into thinking that Donald Trump is literally putting himself between a gunman and a bunch of cats, right?
Definitely. And, you know, in the past, you could have done a bit more work to try to Photoshop something like that. But now it's easy just to hop onto like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney or whatever other app people are using to do this kind of stuff and churn out an image and throw it out there. And people laugh at it for a minute, but then they forget about it, you know, not too long after, because the news cycle moves on and the next thing moves through. I think it's not surprising that people use these tools in weird ways when they're put out to the general public. But I would say that there are definitely nefarious parts of AI, generative AI and AI more broadly, but it's not so much the image generator stuff and the fun stuff like that, right?
You know, one thing that I feel like people don't fully appreciate, because we often talk about AI as being this sort of monolith, but the reality is you have, because it's really stratified types of AI. You have the big services. Like, I use Midjourney a lot for my Substack, and I've learned recently that they have guardrails. I can make images of Trump, but not Harris. I can't do Tim Walz. I can't do JD Vance. Only Trump, which I think is interesting. But there's more and more restrictions about what I can and can't generate. This is true for Stable Diffusion. This is true for a bunch of the big ones. But then we have sort of all down the line different options, including Elon Musk's own proprietary AI service. So, like, tell me a little bit about the guardrail free type of AI.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, and to be clear, like, we're talking about generative AI specifically, right? AI is this broad term that's been around since the 1950s that refers to a lot of things. Like, when you're seeing autocorrect on your phone or you're typing a document and that little line comes under it to say, like, it's probably spelled wrong, that's AI too, right? Just a very much more rudimentary form of it. And so when we're talking about generative AI in these systems, like, whether it's chatbots like ChatGPT or image generators like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney, they need to put certain restrictions on what you're going to get out of it to make that user experience good, but also, you know, to try to not get in trouble, right? There was a story last year that OpenAI had paid these Kenyan workers, you know, contract workers, as much as $2 an hour, basically, to go through like some of the most vile content on the internet, right? To try to scrub it from ChatGPT itself. Like, this is some of the labor that goes into doing these sorts of things. As a result of, you know, decisions like that, someone like Elon Musk, who talks a lot about free speech and the woke mind virus and these kind of right-wing conspiracy theories these days, said that ChatGPT and the products that come from OpenAI are infected by the woke mind virus. They won't let you do or get what you want from it. So he wanted to create this version of a generative AI chatbot or image generator that would have many fewer restrictions on it, let you do much more with it. And of course, it's not just Elon Musk that's doing that. There are a lot of other tools, a lot of other generative AI tools that are trying to do the same thing that are used in very, I would say, nefarious and harmful ways.
Like, what's some real examples here? Because putting aside that, you know, a lot of the real fear mongering has not yet come to pass, and I think increasingly we're of the opinion that it probably won't. Like, what are the bad edge use cases that we're starting to see come from this sort of wild west of generative AI?
Yeah, so the real key one to me that I think doesn't get the attention it deserves is obviously deepfakes, right? And we talk a lot about deepfakes in the political sense of like, okay, you can make Joe Biden say something he didn't say or Donald Trump say something he didn't say. But actually what we're seeing is, in particular, photos of women being taken and putting into these apps and to churn out nude and explicit images of them, right? There was a big controversy around this involving Taylor Swift earlier this year that I think brought it to some more people's attention. But really, this is happening across society to people who are not famous as well. There are a number of issues around the world now of high schools and junior highs where students, where boys are kind of taking pictures of their female classmates and putting them into these apps and making nude images of them and sharing it around with their friends, right? And this is really harmful, like psychologically, to the people who are involved. I've spoken to journalists who have looked into this deeper and spoken to women who basically said that, like, I want to retreat from public life because there are people taking images of me and putting them into these apps. You know, if we're talking about generated images and stuff, this is the really difficult and really harmful piece of it that the companies don't really want to talk very much about and try to kind of wipe their hands of, but they're very much involved in allowing those sorts of things to happen. And we're starting to see some legislative moves in the United States and some other countries. I'm not aware so much of it happening in Canada at the moment, but I think that something like that needs to happen much quicker because that is where, like, you know, we talk a lot about misinformation and whatnot, but I think that is where the real, you know, human harm is.
So anyway, I think someone in Canada is trying to go down this path, but it's difficult. And I think this exposes how hard it is to deal with everything in this space. You can criminalize the actual downstream kind of action, right? Like the actual act of creating the image, which I think is a no-brainer idea in the same way that taking creep shots of people in public also can be criminalized in certain circumstances, sharing the images, ditto. And obviously, you'd hope that we can figure out a way to regulate some of the bigger AI companies into putting up the necessary guardrails and banning users who do this. But again, you deal with this thing where if we're going to see the mass proliferation of open source AI models, as we're increasingly starting to see, thanks to Facebook's Llama generative AI LLM and others, whether it's Grok or other companies that make Grok-like equivalents.
Yeah, Microsoft has been accused of allowing this kind of thing to happen with their tools as well, right?
If anybody can kind of run their own AI in any country, you know, without any sort of particular legislative control over what they do, it feels kind of like the cat's already out of the bag.
I would maybe push back on that to say that if we think that the cat's out of the bag, then it's like, oh, we can't do anything about it, right? But I think that we very clearly can do something about it. And whether it is looking at the people who use it rather than the people who create it, or even the people who create it as well, like if they're in Canada and they're accessible to, you know, Canadian authorities and the Canadian government, then that is something that can be done. On top of all that are a bunch of structural issues too, right? The massive amount of energy that these things require, the water too, to cool them, and how we're seeing the emissions from these major tech companies, Google, Microsoft, and others, just go through the roof as they kind of ignore their pledges to power this generative AI build out. But then, you know, we see governments rolling out AI technologies that are promoted as being more efficient, but often mean that services are pulled back from residents or there's more discrimination built into the system. And these are some of the other bigger issues that we're seeing with this as well.
Stick around after the break and we'll talk about what we can actually do in Canada to limit the negative effects of this technology. Plus, we'll hear a captivating duet between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. I'm having a hard time with it because it does sort of feel like we're going to wind up trying to regulate air, trying to, you know, displace water to some degree. And I really am skeptical that we're going to end up anywhere good. I think more likely we're going to see Canada adopt some like CanCon requirements for AI that I can't imagine is going to exactly make us either a functional regulatory state here or a welcome place for tech innovation.
I would say I'm definitely more skeptical of that. You know, I think that there's a lot of ways that we can look at regulating these things. And what we're really seeing is that over the past couple of decades, there's kind of been this like acceptance, right? That we can't really regulate technology. It's difficult to do, you know, when it comes to the internet specifically. And I think in recent years, we've really seen that begin to break down, particularly when it comes to the power that, you know, in many cases, these American tech companies have developed over, you know, our digital economies and whatnot. Obviously, Europe has been a real leader with its, you know, general data protection regulations, its Digital Markets Act, and, you know, various other regulatory measures that it has brought in to try to rein in these tech companies. But, you know, Canada has done a number of things recently that some people criticize, but I think we're largely good moves to move us forward. Australia is moving even more aggressively than Canada at trying to rein some of these things in. So I think that we're seeing a real shift in, you know, this idea that we couldn't regulate the internet. And now the question is, what is the right way to do it to make sure that yes, we can have access to these technologies if we deem them something that is worthwhile for society, but we also make sure that the negative sides of these things are properly, you know, reined in, considered, regulated. And that is something where the government has a role. And traditionally, when we think of other, you know, media and communications, whether it's broadcasting or radio or what have you, the expectation that the government would be somehow involved was always there. And that only really broke down with the internet itself. And I think that that's changing. And I think that that's welcome.
So listen, I'm a big, kind of a recent convert to the antitrust world. I'm now firmly in the, like, break up everything, just like a wrecking ball, smash these companies to bits, 100%. But when it comes to a lot of the other regulations, I'm just looking at, you know, like the GDPR is a great example. The EU tells all these companies, you need to start respecting consumer privacy. And what do we get? Just an absolute deluge of cookie prompts and pop-ups that are just assaulting you wherever you go, that just asks users to just sell out their privacy and allow for tracking. And just everyone does because they're so bored of dealing with these. And the phrase that a lot of people in the space have started using for just this, that, everything, bad AI models, websites, is education. And I think to bring it back to AI's impact on the election, it seems to me that we are infying all political discourse and AI is helping with that. And that seems to me like the real impact. It's not so much in creating more misinformation. It's just creating spaces that suck, just full of generated garbage and low quality bullshit. And I don't think we're quite ready for what that means, because we're simultaneously going more online and also we're making online bad.
I would say that AI is more of a symptom there rather than a cause, right? Because I think that in general, what we see is, say, on the media side of things, the fact that media and journalism has less funding, which means fewer journalists, which means you can't put, you know, the dedicated resources into doing investigative work, that local journalism is evaporating in this country. You know, Post Media just bought Saltwire and proceeded to gut the St. John's Telegram in Newfoundland and Labrador, where I'm from, which, you know, is part of a broader trend that we've seen across the country. But then, you know, when we look at what's been happening online, for a long time, we had this idea that, you know, we were going to have these platforms, they were going to work well, there was going to be a trade-off, we'd have to look at ads, but you know, in general, they work quite well, but it's reached the point where these companies, their shareholders are still demanding high profits, big revenues, growth in their revenues, and they're unable to deliver that in the way that, you know, they used to. And so what we're seeing now is them basically degrading the experience of using it to try to suck a bit more money out of it. And AI kind of fits into that equation as a way to sure throw more content onto the apps or try to extract a bit more revenue from it. So I see AI as a symptom of these broader economic factors.
I'm more depressed now than ever, but stick around as we recap some more of the happenings of this past week. But before that, I'm going to leave you with the dulcet tones of Donald Trump and Kamala Harris doing a duet.
Wait how long, grenades out, tell my maze and hand for war.
Pen tai to, ye che go, wang shi chong, ki shi chong po.
Happen sun, moods in.
Paris, we'd like to duly note stories so they don't fall through the cracks. Do you have anything you would like to duly note today?
Yeah, so there's a story by Janice McGregor in CBC looking at this recent announcement by the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, that they're canceling 30 export permits that would have been sending arms from Canadian companies to Israel. This comes after, you know, in January, the government said there would be no new export permits, but that didn't cancel the ones that came before. And the way that this story was originally presented, or the way that I initially encountered it, suggested that, like, okay, these 30 were like the ones that were left over and we're done now and there's no more Canadian arms going to Israel. But this analysis by Janice McGregor in CBC said, well, that's not really the case. There's probably over 200 export permits that are still valid. And so canceling 30, yes, it takes some more down, but there's still a lot of weapons that are going from Canadian companies over to Israel. And some of those are even going to the United States first and then going to Israel from there to try to bypass some of these restrictions. So
at the very least, can we stop sending arms from Canada to Israel as it engages in a genocide against the people of Gaza? It's not just me saying that. It's Independent Jewish Voices Canada, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, the founder of Human Rights Watch, and of course, the International Court of Justice ruled earlier this year that Israel was plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, a case that will take some time to get a final verdict.
It's really disappointing, but unfortunately, our government can't even do that very minimum bit.
Just pick a lane at a certain point, right? I mean, you know, where does Canada want to be on this conflict? I appreciate that we don't have quite the same foreign policy gravitas that we had. And maybe even that's mythical, but either way, like, do we want to be involved in forcing a ceasefire, in making Netanyahu's, making his government untenable? Do we want to be on the side that tries to push Israel towards peace? Or do we just want to muddle through and let, you know, the Americans fundamentally dictate the world response and that let EU be kind of the voice of conscience? And it seems very clear that we just do not have a sort of strategy, a plan, an ethos, a mission, a statement even. It is so ad hoc, slapdash, and amateur.
Yeah, I remember when the Liberals came to power, Justin Trudeau said Canada is back on the world stage, right? But now it feels like so much of our foreign policy is really just like whatever the United States wants it to be. And I think that the Liberal government stance on what's happening in Gaza right now is going to be a black mark, not just on this Liberal government, but on Canada's legacy here as well.
There's so much room to do it constructively and thoughtfully and effectively, to give voice to the growing number of people here and abroad, including many Jews and Israelis who just are very, very sick of this war, including, by the way, the hostages and families who desperately want a friggin' ceasefire deal. Anyway, duly noted. All right, so Paris, as we know, I think as anyone listening knows, Canadian music journalism has not had a fantastic decade. If journalism is hurting anyway, music journalism has been kind of the first thing to go. But it bums me out right now because the Polaris Music Prize was awarded this week. We're recording it right now. We don't know the results. That's okay. But the gala was earlier this week, and I've seen zero buzz about it, zero coverage. And I realize it's an indie music award. It's not going to be exactly front page news. Fine, fair enough. But it was particularly sad because one of my favorite records for this past year, not just Canadian in general, maybe one of my favorite records of the past like 5 years, honestly, or at least kind of up there, is up for the prize. And I feel like if we just had an iota of sort of artistic pride in ourselves, we would be sort of jazzed about it, and we're not. And it's not, unfortunately, Jeremy Dutcher's album, who is a friend and a fantastic musician, it's not his. It's Cindy Lee's Diamond Jubilee. Have you listened to this album?
I have not.
You won't find it streaming anywhere. This is, I think, maybe he's turned some people off the album. You can only get it via her GeoCities page.
Oh, that's cool, though.
You know, Cindy Lee.
Now I want to listen to it.
Yeah, it's so good. Cindy Lee is sort of a drag artist slash fuzzy lo-fi indie musician slash a whole bunch of other stuff. But the record's available on YouTube, but mainly through the GeoCities page, because they are boycotting the pro-war, pro-capitalism, pro-etc. stance of Spotify, Apple, and everybody else. And frankly, awesome fun. The album is so good. It's a double album that can only be described as music coming from a haunted doll. And I think it is one of the most fun, ingenious, clever, fantastic, listenable, exciting records I've heard in ages, and I just think it is due for a little bit more hurrah.
I love that. I'll have to listen to it after this. Duly noted.
Before we go, stay tuned for some more stories we've been following this week, including an update on who's actually won the Polaris Prize. But first, let's say goodbye to our guest, Paris. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, I enjoyed the conversation.
If you want to hear more from Paris on tech, they should check out your podcast, Tech Won't Save Us. But where can people find your book, for example?
Yeah, my book is Road to Nowhere, What Silicon Valley Gets Wrong About the Future of Transportation. Guess at any bookstore where they want to check it out. Or, you know, if you do the e-reading thing, I'm sure it's on those platforms too. But it was great to join you.
Here's some more stories we're following this week. First, we have the results from the Polaris Prize. The Polaris Prize was awarded to, dun-dun-dun, unbelievably talented, brilliant Montreal-based vocalist Jeremy Dutcher. He's the first Polaris Prize winner to ever win twice, and honestly, good for him. Absolutely, everyone go buy his album, Metal Will Nuke. I'm still riding for Cindy Lee, but okay, you know what, fair enough. Maybe you lose when you refuse to do press and you cancel your tour midway through. Whatever, congrats to Jeremy. We've been following this other story for quite a while. Bello Sun, a Canadian mining company, is trying to build the largest open pit gold mine in Brazil, but locals are protesting the human rights abuses and environmental impacts associated with the project. Bello's son, in turn, filed a criminal lawsuit against them. Now, the fact that Bello's son is threatening activists has gotten the attention of the UN. Charisse Sutren digs deep with the UN Special Rapporteur on Monday. Federal politics has, as I'm sure you're well aware, been a mess in Canada over the last couple of weeks. On Tuesday, we take stock of what's been happening and where we're headed. Plus, we're introducing our new host, Noor Azria. We will also be talking about the two shocking and sophisticated Israeli attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, involving exploding pagers and walkie-talkies and solar panels. You know, these attacks have injured thousands and resulted in over 20 deaths. Obviously, this is a huge international story. It may signal the start of a wider regional war and the recognition of assassination as a tool of international affairs, okay? But it's also a big deal for Canadians. The Lebanese community in Canada includes between 200 and 400,000 people, while an estimated 40 to 75,000 Canadians live in Lebanon. On Wednesday, we'll take a look at how this is affecting them. In lighter news, the federal court has upheld a decision from the Canada Revenue Agency determining that Ezra Levant's rebel news